Let's talk a little bit about some of the defenses to malpractice action. Some of the things that are frequently brought up if a doctor is in fact sued. How do you defend yourself? One of the big defenses to malpractice, strangely enough, you may not think of this, but lawyers are officers of the court. I'm sure you've heard that term before. They're officers of the court. They owe a responsibility to the court. They owe a responsibility to use the judicial system in the way that it was intended to be used, not for frivolous lawsuits and not just for monetary gain, but to carry out justice. A fairly high-minded principle here. So lawyers, being officers of the court, have a responsibility to the court. And one of the big responsibilities these days, in the days of very crowded judicial system, the court systems are just jam-packed, and one of the frequent things that is brought up about the court system is just how overburdened it is and how it can't function well because it's overburdened. So it's very important that lawyers only bring cases that have merit into the court system. They can't just bring a case in because somebody wants to sue somebody unless the case has legal merit. So in a malpractice action, one of the big protections that is offered is that a lawyer to whom a client comes wishing to sue somebody has the obligation to screen that case and to say to the potential plaintiff in the case, "Mrs. Jones, I know you're mad, but you really don't have enough here for a lawsuit. You don't really measure up in terms of a lawsuit." So a lot of people get mad for various reasons, and they'll, on the spur of the moment, decide they want to sue somebody. And the way our system is set up, you generally have to go to a lawyer. That's one of the things you have to do. So you go to the lawyer, you state your case to the lawyer. The lawyer owes the court system the responsibility of screening that case, of saying, "This is not a case that belongs in the court. I'm sorry." You may find another lawyer who will take the case, maybe. But a lawyer owes responsibility to the system. So probably a good many malpractice cases that would otherwise end up in the court system get screened right at this point. That the lawyer talks their prospective client out of filing the case and just says, "I don't think you have a good case." What he has to look at here are the legal points of law and say, if you want to file a malpractice case, we have to have duty, negligence, injury, and causal connection. And as I review the case, I don't see those elements. I just don't see that we would have a case. And so the case gets kept out of the court system by a prudent lawyer deciding not to take the case. Lawyers have some authority over them that kind of makes them responsible to do this. If they bring a case into court that is not legally meritous, does not have legal merit, a judge will jump right in the middle of them and tell them, "What are you doing bringing this case into my court?" A judge has the authority to fine a lawyer and say, "You shouldn't bring these kinds of cases into my court." That situation is called abuse of process. The lawyer is abusing the legal process by bringing a non-meritorious case into the court, taking up the court's time and wasting judicial time with a frivolous case. And a lawyer will be fined, and the plaintiff, the client who tries to bring the case, may be fined. And then you can be fined $1,000 for it. Abuse of process. If you try to file a case just to be vindictive or just to be punitive to someone, and you kind of know it doesn't really have legal merit, but you say, "I'm going to sue them anyway and hassle them," you may be found guilty of abuse of process. You can be fined. You can be put in jail for it. It's up to a judge's whims, and judges don't like their time wasted. So a lawyer who continually brings cases in that are of little legal merit, they're probably going to find themselves on the bad side of a judge, and the judge is likely to take action against the lawyer and the plaintiff in this kind of case. So a kind of a defense or Something that keeps so many malpractice cases from being filed is just the fact that a good lawyer will screen his cases carefully and say, you know, I know you're mad and I know you'd like to sue, but this is just not a good case and it's not something we're going to sue for. So we do have that protection of a lawyer who screens cases. As he's screening, this brings up number two, he is screening, if he determines through the facts, he listens to the facts and says, there really is no negligence in the case. The absence of negligence is sort of a complete defense. So if we can't find negligence, there's no reason to bring a lawsuit. If we can't make a case that the doctor in a malpractice case, that a doctor was negligent, then there's no use bringing a case because the absence of negligence is a complete defense. And you don't need to go any farther if you can't establish that there was negligence. So there are unfortunate cases where an injury occurs. Sometimes it happens. An injury occurs, but there was no negligence. Then that is not malpractice. It doesn't meet the formula. And if you don't have negligence, you don't have malpractice, the judge is going to say, don't waste my time. I'm sorry. So we just don't have negligence, we don't have malpractice. There are occasions when there may actually be a little bit of negligence, there may be an injury, but you know, sometimes the patient in a malpractice case, the patient may actually contribute to the injury. You know, in the case of a doctor or a chiropractor who tells the patient, look, you have an injury here, I really don't think you ought to be at work lifting, I'm going to give you a note that says you should be off work for a week, or I don't think you ought to be exercising, I don't think you ought to be running in that marathon, I don't think you ought to be lifting weights. You know, activities that may be harmful to the patient. If you give advice against doing those particular activities, the patient goes ahead and does them anyway, then and maybe causes some more damage, they can't really come back and sue you when they have contributed to the injury themselves. Or maybe that's the only injury. Maybe they're avoiding your particular precautions may actually be the only injury. But there are cases where people are mad because of some injury, they end up suing, and it turns out that they themselves have actually contributed to the negligence, they've contributed to the injury, and in that case, the doctor usually is not going to be held liable and will not be found guilty of malpractice. If the doctor did in fact exhibit negligent behavior and cause some level of injury, which was compounded by the patient's behavior, if in fact the doctor was guilty of that, there are cases where the judge will order juries to determine what percentage of the injury was caused by the doctor and what percentage was caused by the patient's own negligence. And after a jury determines that percentage, you may get a prorated award. If they were going to give you $1 million but they only found that the doctor was 40% of the negligence belonged to the doctor, you only get $400,000 instead of $1 million. You get 40% of the award. In some cases, it's done that way. There is actually a prorating of the amount of negligence. How much negligent was the doctor? How much was the patient? And we'll actually prorate the award, if any, on that basis. So this is the concept here is called contributory negligence. There are occasions in law when the patient actually contributes to the problem. Famous case about this was a dental case. And, you know, you've all been to the dentist, you probably all had a Novocaine injection. You know, the doctor comes out with a big needle and sticks it in your mouth somewhere to numb you up so you can do a procedure. It happened in this particular case that he gave the Novocaine shot to a patient, and as he was removing the needle, it broke off in the gums. And that causes us all to cringe. We don't like the idea of that. And this patient didn't like it. But you know, dentists are trained to deal with that eventuality. Things like that happen, and that's one of the things in their training. And so they say to the patient, I'm sorry, the needle has broken off in your gums. I'm going to get it out. I know how to do it. And I'll get my little needle nose pliers and pull it out. Or if I have to make a little incision, if the needle broke below the gum line, I'll make a little incision. We'll take out the needle. We'll take a stitch. We'll, you know, I know what to do. So the dentist in this case says, I know what to do. Just relax. I'm going to take care of everything. The patient panicked, got up, ran out of the office, ended up in a day or two going to some other dentist, having the needle removed, and says, oh, I suffered severe trauma, mental trauma, and anguish, and all, and pain and suffering, and all this kind of stuff because of the actions of the first dentist. And then they had it removed by the second dentist. In this case, which actually did go to court, the judge's ruling was this. The judge says, because they were bringing up this concept of contributory negligence, well, maybe the needle broke, but you know, we're not saying that was negligence, that's just one of those things that happens. But if it were negligence, then the patient, by not allowing the doctor to deal with the problem, the doctor who's trained to deal with that, not allowing him to deal with that problem, the patient actually contributed to his own psychic trauma and his own anguish and pain and suffering. So there's a contributory factor in here. The judge's ruling in the case was a wise one, and it said something to the effect that the patient's conduct was not contributory negligence in this case. It was the only negligence. So it didn't contribute, it was the only negligence. The doctor was not negligent. Those kinds of things do happen. The doctor is trained to deal with it. It's not fun, but the doctor is trained to deal with it. So the doctor was not negligent in his behavior, only the patient was negligent. So the concept of contributory negligence comes into play when there's maybe some question as to whether the doctor's action or the patient's action was most, contributed most to the injury and the negligence. Another defense to malpractice is something called release and satisfaction. Release and satisfaction means the case has been settled. And we know in malpractice actions like automobile accidents and other kinds of court actions, cases get settled out of court. They will go all the way up to the courtroom steps in the preparation of the trial, and then it gets settled right at the last minute, or somewhere in the process of preparation it gets settled. And what generally happens in the settlement is some money changes hands, an award is given by somebody, some money actions transpire, a document is signed, and that document is called a release and satisfaction document. It says that I am satisfied and I am releasing the defendant in this case. I'm releasing the defendant from all further action. So this is a release and satisfaction document, a very common end to malpractice actions. Somebody gets paid off. Very often somebody may sue for $5 million and then when a little bit of money is dangled before them, they'll take $5,000 and they sign a release and satisfaction and the case is over. That's it. There's no further action. Another end of a malpractice case is something called a verdict in favor. If a case actually goes to trial and goes through the whole process, guess what? Doctors win most of the time. Doctors actually win most cases. They can verify and document that they weren't negligent, and the expert witness on their side convinces the jury that they weren't negligent. The jury buys the fact they weren't negligent. No award is given. The doctor wins the case. So this is a very frequent end of a malpractice action. Doctors win in a high percentage of cases. And it's important to note that, that even though you're sued, the chances of an award being given are not that great. You may have to go through the pain and the anguish of a lawsuit, but your assets are not taken and distributed. So a verdict in favor is fairly common. The other thing that comes into play here in terms of these cases is something called the statute of limitations. There are laws concerning when a plaintiff, the complaining person, has to file a lawsuit. You cannot indefinitely just sit on a lawsuit and wait and wait and wait and many years down the road file a lawsuit. There is a time limit for doing that. The most typical time limit in dealing with malpractice actions is a 3-year period. And your question might be, 3 years from when? Some states establish this statute of limitations, this time period, from the time that the patient became your patient, 3 years from that time, or the time that the patient was dismissed from care, 3 years from dismissal, or most common is 3 years from the time that the injury was noticed or could have been noticed by a reasonable and prudent person. So 3 years from the time they discovered that they were hurt. Because we know there may be a time gap between the time of the actual incident and the time that a person discovers that they were hurt. Remember, we mentioned the case of leaving a hemostat inside a surgical wound. You may not find out that it's in there for 3 years or 5 years. You don't even know it was there. But the moment you find out, the clock starts ticking. You have 3 years from the time you find out that you're injured. A common case in chiropractic is an allegation that chiropractor gave an adjustment and herniated a disc. How did the person know they had a herniated disc? They went to a neurosurgeon sometime later. They ended up having surgery. The surgery confirms the fact that there was a herniated disc. The surgical report indicates that the disc nucleus was outside the surrounding tissue and therefore it was herniated. That confirms it. That's the moment when you know you had a herniated disc. So you have 3 years from that time period. Right now, and this is March of 2001, I'm involved as an expert witness in a malpractice case that took place in 1996. The incident took place in 1996. The woman came to the chiropractor's office, got adjusted, and sometime later had surgery for a herniated disc. So that was 96. She filed the lawsuit one day before the 3 years was up. She filed it in 1999. And so the case was filed. She met the statute of limitations by filing the action in 1999, 3 years after the incident. It is now 2001, and we're about to go to court. Probably go to court in May of 2001. So you got a 5-year period here from the incident over to the time it comes to court, which is not that unusual. Because of this statute of limitations situation, you may postpone filing the case for up to 3 years. So in this case, it takes 5 years for it to actually get to court. If she would have waited one day beyond 3 years, the statute of limitations would have been up and she would not be allowed to file the case. And they would say, too late. It's tough. You waited too long. So you have to be cognizant and be cautious about this statute of limitations situation. It's important that you understand that.